Today's Taisho will be on Case 5 in the Mumonkan, the Umenkwan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 5 is entitled Kyogen's Man Up in the Tree. Kyogen Osho said, "It is like a man up in a tree, hanging from a branch with his mouth. His hands grasp no bough. His feet rest on no limb. Someone appears under the tree and asks him, 'What is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the west?' If he does not answer, he fails to respond to the question. If he does answer, he will lose his life. What would you do in such a situation?" Mumon's comment, "Even if your eloquence flows like a river, it is of no avail. Though you can expound the whole of Buddhist literature, it is of no use. If you solve this problem, you will give life to the way that has been dead up until this moment and destroy the way that has been alive up to now. Otherwise, you must wait for Maitreya Buddha and ask him." Mumon's verse, "Kyogen is truly thoughtless. His vice and poison are endless. He stops up the mouths of the monks, and devil's eyes sprout from their bodies." I want to thank everybody for coming here today and practicing Sesshin. Sesshin is really special practice, something really quite wonderful and quite rare. If you have friends, you might sometimes talk about Zen, and some of them might understand it, and some of them won't understand it. I had a friend when I was in graduate school. Her name was Colleen McElroy, and she was a very beautiful African-American poet. And I worked for Colleen for a while. She was not just a poet, but she also ran a special writing program for economically disadvantaged students. And I worked for her. I taught in that program for a couple of years. And anyway, I was on University Avenue talking to a friend, and Colleen walked by, and we stopped our conversation. And my friend said, "Oh, Kurt and I were just talking about Zen." And she said, "Well, that sounds interesting. I'm interested in sin myself." She said, "Oh, no, not sin, Zen." She said, "Oh," she looked kind of disappointed. So she really wouldn't have, if you knew her, she's a very beautiful, sexy lady. But I guess Zen wasn't her cup of tea. And, you know, I come from a family of people who, my father was actively disapproving of what I of Zen practice, and so I tried to teach my brother to sit. He was quite ill, so it was really too late for him to learn. But even so, it didn't make a lot of sense to him. And whenever I see my sister, she always says, "You've got to teach me how to sit." And then it never gets any farther than that. And also my wife's family too, they also will sometimes try to be interested. And then they'll ask me questions about Zen, and they'll seem interested. And suddenly I realize they're not interested at all, they're just trying to be polite, you know. And so, you know, they're wonderful people, and I'm glad I know them. But, you know, the heart of my life is really Zen practice. And so when I meet people who want to practice Zen, you know, it's like I remember seeing this a long time ago. I remember seeing a MTV video, and it was about a little girl who was dressed in a bee suit. You know those bee suits? She had a black leotards on, and she had the body was like round, like a bee with stripes on it, with a little like stinger on the bottom, and wings. And she had goggles pulled up over her head, you know, and a yellow head hat, you know, like a bee's, tight, like a swimming cap, yellow. And she was walking around, and everybody was looking at her like, who are you? Where are you from? You know? And she just didn't fit in. You know, so many people were playing ball, and she went over and she tried to play ball, and they all were looking at this person in a bee suit, and she looked so dejected. And so she started walking over this hill, and on the other side of the hill were all these people in bee suits. You know? And so they're skipping rope, you know. And so I sometimes feel like that, you know. It's like, oh, so you're interested in this wonderful practice, you know. So it's actually quite rare, you know. People hear about this and they're not interested, and some people read about it and they're intellectually stimulated, but they don't practice. And then some people actually are interested in practice. And you know, we advertise at Rutgers University, and we always get maybe between 20 and maybe 50 or 60 students who come each fall semester to try it, and only one or two actually stay, you know, for any length of time. So it's really quite wonderful to meet people who practice this beautiful path, who want to practice it. And I'm just very glad you're here. It's always a pleasure to see you. And there's something very precious about this. A little earlier, I mentioned a couple of days ago, there's a new person in our group whose name is Mary. And I don't think she would mind my quoting her, because this wasn't in Dokusan, and it was said publicly for everybody to hear. But after a sit, I said, how was your sit? And she said, it was wonderful. And then I said, are you practicing at home? You know, and she said, I can't. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, first of all, she said, I have two little kids, you know, and I'm very busy with that. And then, you know, it's the hubbub of the house. You know, it's very busy. I guess they have an apartment or a house, and you know, it's every minute, all the time is taken up with, you know, worldly matters, you know. And she said, but also there's just something about psychologically, it's so hard for me to sit still and to do this on my own. I just don't have the ability. But she's been coming faithfully to the university, at least she's often there two or three times a week. You know, she makes a point, and she loves her sitting. And she said, I don't know what I would do without this structure. You know, so there's something really quite special about this. You know, having a structure of daily and weekly practice, and then sesshin is really like the capstone of this whole thing. It's what Zen is all about. We have the opportunity to practice together for many hours a day. If you count the time we sit on the cushion reciting sutras and so on and so on, it's quite a long day. It's like nine plus hours. So that's a lot of meditation together. And it takes a few days, but gradually the mind settles down and becomes clear. And when this happens, it's really quite wonderful, you know. Normally, our minds are very scattered, and they're pulled in many different directions. And sesshin literally means to unify the mind. Isn't that interesting? So we're unifying the mind, or what we could also call it clarifying or purifying the mind. So we come to Sesshin, and at first, you know, all of these things are sort of brought into the building with us, you know, our fears and anxieties, our expectations, and so on. But little by little, you know, if you keep watching your breath or calling mu, the mind is going to become more and more calm and focused. And when this happens, you're going to reach a state which is very difficult to achieve in ordinary life. It's very difficult. Even if you've been practicing for many years, you know, it's very difficult to achieve this state. You know, earlier in the week, I was talking about this wonderful book that I've gotten. It's called In the Buddha's Words, an Anthology of Discourses from the Pali Canon. And I mentioned that these are some of the earliest teachings of Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha. And unfortunately, I mentioned earlier, at the risk of repeating myself, I want to share a little bit of this with everybody. The original Buddhist teachings were recalled by the Buddha's followers. And when the Buddha was teaching, he would meet people, and they would ask him questions. And he would answer their questions in detail. And these discussions were sometimes private, but sometimes other monks were with him. And when they heard what he had to say, they would try to remember it. And after the Buddha's death, they all got together, and the Buddha himself had not written anything down. But his followers thought it was very important to preserve his teachings. So they committed these conversations to memory. And the title of these early sutras is often based on the person the Buddha was speaking with, person or persons. And so we have these wonderful teachings that may indeed be the words of something close to what the Buddha actually said. And I've been reading them, and they're quite inspiring. One of the things the Buddha says is that the householder's life is not made for enlightenment. And this is actually so, you know. The Buddha says, he said, you know, and if you think about his time in particular, he said houses are cramped and noisy and dirty, and people are just struggling to survive. And even though today, you know, we have nice houses, you know, the householder's life is not designed for enlightenment. Just not. You know, many years ago, I remember reading about a man named Bernie Glassman. And Bernie Glassman was a student of Maizumi Roshi. He had gone to Sesshin. And after Sesshin, he came home and he went to sleep. And the next day, he had to go to work. And the guys, he was a chemical engineer, I believe. And his carpool car picked him up, and he got into the car, and he had a Daikensho experience in the car. And he was crying and laughing, and his friends thought he had gone totally nuts. Right? They were going to take him to the mental hospital. And he said, please don't take me to the mental hospital, just take me home. I'll have a sick day today. And then he found Maizumi Roshi and so on. And I went to see Mazen Roshi and explained what was happening to him. These kinds of experiences are very inspiring. You shouldn't try to have a Kensho experience. You should just cultivate Muhu Shin. But the point is, this happened because he had gone to Sashin. In other words, people don't have those spontaneous Kensho experiences ordinarily in the carpool on the way to work. Right? Just doesn't happen. The average American, in his quest for wisdom, the average American has watched hundreds of thousands of hours of TV. Right? That's a fact. Yeah. In other words, not a quest for wisdom, is my point. We have TV, we have the pressures of work, we have paying bills, having a home, having a family, these are noble enterprises. And indeed, interestingly enough, the Buddha says many householders had achieved Daikensho in his original teachings. It's very interesting to read these early teachings because the Buddha is asked, are you the only one who has had Daikensho? And the Buddha says, no, actually that's not the case. I have many students who have also had Daikensho. And he said, not just one monk, not just 100 monks, but hundreds of monks. And then he says, not just one nun, not 100 nuns, but hundreds of nuns have had Daikensho. And then he says, not just one householder, not just one male householder, in other words, not just one layman, but not just 100 laymen, but hundreds of laymen have had Daikensho. And then he says, not just one laywoman, not 100, but hundreds of laywomen have had Daikensho. And then he goes on to talk about people who haven't had Daikensho yet, but who have benefited in various ways from the teaching. That's a very important point because you don't have to become a home leaver and enter a monastery to have Daikensho, but you do have to make a place in your life for practice. And something like Sashin is indispensable. There may be times in your life where Sashin isn't possible on a regular basis, but on the whole, if you want to practice this path, it's very important to do what we're doing here. And so this is an indispensable part of Zen practice. And it's a wonderful opportunity that people have been taking advantage of for literally thousands of years since the Buddha's time. People have been coming together like this and practicing. One of the other interesting things that I found in here that was so inspiring to me was, people who practice together, I think, create very deep human relationships. I think that they're the deepest human relationships. I think that people who go through this practice together have a kind of intimacy which is unlike anything else in the world. It's like many people know my small self, but some people have encountered my emptiness, yeah? And I think when we come together in our big mind, big self, it's very different and I think very special kind of relationship, really deeply intimate. You have a self which is X number of years old, and it's male or female, and it's an artist or an accountant or scientist, but you also have a life which is different from that. And many people don't really see that deeper life. But we here share that deeper life together. And anyway, this is from one of the sutras. And the sutras usually start out, "Thus have I heard." See? And they start out that way because it's usually some monk saying, this is what I heard the Buddha say. So they all start out, "Thus have I heard." On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Sakyans, where there was a town of the Sakyans named Nagaraka. Then the Venerable Ananda, the Buddha's nephew, approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side and said, "Venerable Sir, this is half of the spiritual life, that is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. This is half of the spiritual life." And the Buddha said, "Not so, Ananda, not so. This is the entire spiritual life, Ananda, that is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. When a monk or a nun has a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade, it is to be expected that he or she will develop and cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path." So I just think that's so interesting, you know, that there's a kind of deep a Dharma friendship that people cultivate or discover when they practice together like this. We all got up at 4:30 this morning, and we all dragged ourselves into the bathroom and brushed our teeth and all came out here to sit. We all recited sutras. And it's not that, it's not doing it together alone that's special, but that we're sharing this emptiness together. That's really, I think, quite beautiful and wonderful. Of course, when people come to Sesshin, they don't necessarily have, they're not necessarily 100% ready for the encounter with emptiness, you know. In fact, almost nobody is, to tell you the truth. Mostly, people come to Sesshin with something less than 100% willingness to encounter emptiness deeply. And so, usually, what we're trying to do is get something out of the deal, if I can put it that way, you know. Now, when I got into Zen practice, I was like very unhappy person, and I was depressed a lot of the time. And I think I'd been depressed for years. I wasn't diagnosed. I don't think I was clinically depressed. That is, I didn't sit in bed all day. But I think I was sort of like low-level depressed for a long time. And when I started doing Zen, I didn't know it at the time consciously, but I felt a lot better. And when I started going to Sesshin, I felt, even though it was so difficult, I felt better too, you know. And once I felt better, I began to have crazy ideas, like, I wanted to be like Genki Roshi. You know, he was really somebody I admired, and I thought, you know, I was reading all these books on Zen, and I thought, maybe someday I will be like a great Zen master, you know. And these aspirations to be a great Zen master actually got in my way quite a bit. Because instead of being in the moment, I was constantly trying to do something great with my koan. I was constantly trying to come up with a great answer to my koan instead of just letting go. I know other people too who came to Sesshin for various reasons. Some people did Zen practice because they wanted to improve their concentration. And in Seattle, there were quite a large number of Japanese people who would practice with Genki Roshi And they did it because they would only do it once a year as a way of atoning for their mistakes. So they would come to Sesshin, and this was like doing penance, right? So these people were like, they, you know, Sesshin was rough, and they knew it was rough, and the rougher it was, the better, because they felt like, now I'm really suffering, and that's good, you know, because I'm getting rid of my bad deeds, you know. So if you think about it, people often come to Sesshin with a kind of bargain mentality. They want to get something out of the deal. And I think even everybody does this. You know, everybody does this, I think. Maybe I'm mistaken, but we're all looking for something. You know, we're looking for even if it's enlightenment, we're all looking for something. But actually, another way to put it is we're all trying to win, you know? It's like we're trying to win. We're trying to get the lottery, hit the lottery, right? For a long time, I would go to Sesshin thinking, maybe this will be the one. This will be the one where I have my great awakening experience. And I would sometimes leave Sesshin so dejected because I didn't have a Kensho experience. And in fact, for many years, I couldn't even answer the breath perception koan. And I was told to watch my breath, but I wanted to be a great Zen master. And so I would have all these ridiculous answers I would give to Genki Roshi. And then after I eventually passed that koan, you know, I was always trying to somehow, control the experience of being at Sesshin. I was trying, I don't know how to put it, but I was trying to get on top of the situation and maintain a kind of a control over things. But if you stay at Sesshin long enough, you lose the desire, you just realize you can't control anything anymore. That's really one of the most beautiful things about Sesshin, you know, is that you realize you can't control anything anymore. And that, I think, is the beginning of like real liberation, you know. This koan is so interesting because it's like the koan about Sesshin. Kyogen Osho said, it's like a man up in a tree hanging from a branch with his mouth. See, I don't know if you ever have had, do you ever have like crazy dreams? Especially at Sesshin, you may have crazy dreams. But, when I was younger, I used to have a dream a lot where people would be chasing me and I'd start flapping my arms and fly away. Maybe you've had that dream. And sometimes it would be like I couldn't get off the ground. I really had to flap, you know, and they were trying to grab my feet and things like that, you know. And sometimes I'd just zoom up in the air, you know. Well, apparently, you might have a dream where you're hanging by a limb, by your teeth. And basically, you know, in the dream there's no place to grab onto with your hands and there's nowhere to put your feet. Now, nobody likes to be in a situation like that, right? I mean, and in our daily lives, we're often in a situation like that, you know, where we're just, you know, in fact, you know, actually, I think ordinary life is very much just a matter of, like, hanging on for dear life, you know? I can remember one of the most horrible experiences for me was coming to Rutgers and being worried about tenure, you know, because you work in a job for 6 years and then you're either fired or you're given lifetime employment, you know. Now that's a good deal, right? I mean, lifetime employment, almost even the gods can't ask for that, right? You know, but the truth is, you know, if you don't get it, you're out. And it's like, one minute you could be a professor of English, and the next minute you could be, basically Do you want to cope with those fries, sir? You know, I mean, that could happen, right? Before I became an English professor, I was a janitor. I moved furniture. I worked in a restaurant. You know, so it was like, well, I wonder if they have any jobs there at the moving company after I, you know. So I was very worried about this, you know, and it was like hanging by my teeth, you know. And even you know, even if you have tenure, you know, I've been involved in Rutgers for 25 years, and I've done built up a lot of things at Rutgers, and now the budget cut might wipe them all away. You know, so I'm trying to save my 25 years of work at Rutgers. You know, and we're facing a terrible budget crisis, and it could just be like, even though I did this every day for 25 years and, you know, put my soul into it, so to speak, and my heart into it, you know, somebody with a stroke of the pen could put that all in the trash can, you know. So that's like hanging with your, by your teeth. And you know, we all, life somehow makes us hang by our teeth, right? You know, and the alternative, you know, the koan says there is an alternative. And you say, oh, great, what's that? And you're hanging by your teeth in your dream, and somebody walks along and says, why did Bodhidharma come to the West? In other words, please help me to wake up. If you can't say a word to help me wake up, I will wander in suffering. I will continue to wander in suffering. Can you help me? And you're hanging by your teeth, just trying not to lose your grip, right? So you have the koan says you have a choice. You can hang, continue to hang, which nobody likes, and that's one hell of an option, right? Or you can open your mouth, right, to help this person. But if you open your mouth, you're going to drop down you're going to drop off a cliff, right? You drop. So have any of you ever had falling dreams? Where you're falling in space. Some people, when they work with this koan, they say, oh no, I would fly. But see, the koan doesn't give you that option, you know. Koan wants you to see something about life, which is that actually humans can't fly. See? So you have a choice. You can either hang by the skin of your teeth, or you can drop. Right? Just fall, free fall. Which will it be? See? Now, this is very much about sesshin, in my opinion. Because sesshin is learning how to fall. Or learning how to hang. You know, your choice. Either way, it's a choice, but both of these are unpleasant alternatives, right? The mind says, I want, it's A or B, and A is bad and B is bad, right? You know, one of the interesting things is that, I was talking about this yesterday, but, you know, I think it's fascinating that the Buddha, you know, the Buddha was supposedly like a king. He was probably really like a tribal chieftain, right? Or the son of a tribal chieftain. There was a very large group, they were the Sakyans, you know, and they actually had a little country called the Sakya Republic. And the Buddha could have become, you know, the leader of the Sakya Republic, but he didn't. And, you know, the Buddha, I think it's interesting, you know, the Buddha he had like lots of money at his disposal. He was very compassionate. People who met the Buddha were moved, deeply moved by his extraordinary kindness. This is something that has come down through the ages, right? That people apparently found him very deeply moving. So people find the Dalai Lama that way, right? People just immediately open up to the Dalai Lama, and they don't even know who the Dalai Lama is, but they immediately, oh, the Dalai Lama, he's so nice. Well, there's something about him, you know, he's done a lot of sitting. And there was something about the Buddha, he was just very lovable and evoked love from people. But, you know, even though he had great compassion and love for human beings, you know, he didn't do something that's interesting. You know, he had all the money in the world. Why didn't he create like a welfare state? Huh? Why didn't he create like Denmark, you know? Take the Shakya Republic and make it into Denmark. And, you know, and actually there was a Buddhist who tried to do that. Actually, Ashoka, the emperor of India, tried to create like a Buddhist society. It didn't last very long, unfortunately. But the Buddha didn't decide to create like a social safety net and so on and so on. And I think there should be a social safety net. But the Buddha said something interesting. He said, it would be nice if everybody were rich, but actually I've been rich. And he said, it would be nice if everybody were secure, but you know, I've actually been secure. And he said, there is no condition. There is no satisfactory situation. In other words, you can't possibly win. Now this runs very much against our American mindset, right? Because we think, well, if this is an unsatisfactory situation, we'll just change it. And many people practice Zen with that kind of mindset, right? So I'm going to use Zen to get from point A to point B, from a bad situation to a better situation. And in fact, somebody might say, well, if that's not what I'm doing here, what the hell am I doing here? But the interesting thing to me is that the Buddha didn't say, he could have created like a very beautiful country, like Switzerland, you know, or Bhutan even. And he could have tried to protect people from sickness, old age and death, and so on. But he didn't do it. Now, I will, if we ever have a socialist party in America, I'll definitely become a member. And I think that like Scandinavian countries are great. You know. But nevertheless, it's interesting that the Buddha didn't try to do something like that. That what he said instead was, there is no satisfactory condition. There is no satisfactory situation. That's really what he said. And so hanging is an unsatisfactory situation, and a falling is an unsatisfactory situation. Now, there's if you come to Sesshin looking for like a more satisfactory situation, well, some people come to Sesshin hoping for like kripalu experience, you know. So I get these catalogs for a yoga center in upstate New York, upstate New England, Massachusetts, I guess, downstate Massachusetts, somewhere in Massachusetts, central Massachusetts. And it's full of beautiful, smiling people, you know, who are in peak physical health, and they come to Kripalu, and they have a designer building, which is built by a world famous green architect, and you can eat the delicious food, and the idea is that you're going to come to Kripalu, and you're going to heal, and become healthier, and you're going to have a better life. Now that is okay. You know, that's okay. That's a wonderful motive, but it's not quite what Sesshin is all about. Because actually, even if you go to Kripalu, believe it or not, It's not going to be a satisfactory experience in some way. And you can say, well, that's pessimistic, but you know, actually, the truth is that all conditions of existence have a shadow. And if anybody says it's not true, I think they're not being honest. You know, there's always a shadow. You know, we come to the moment expecting this, and then something else happens. And it's heartbreaking, right? It's like, this is not what I want. This is not the moment I wanted. You know, now, I imagine that a place like Kripalu has, like, testimonials and so on, but I can't help but feel that there's a little bit of, it's like not looking at the whole of life. You know, there is a, there's a sort of like, there's a tragic dimension to life. You know, there just is. I'm sure you've felt it, you know. You could say, okay, I don't believe you, you know, I don't believe you. I think that there is a condition in which it's totally satisfactory, and you're free to look, you know. But my personal feeling is that at any rate, there's another option besides continuing to look for that. And that is what we're doing on the cushion. You know, there is a there's another way to live. If you go to Kripalu, something special is there. But if you don't go to Kripalu, something special is there. See, if you go to the doctor, and the doctor says, "My God, you're in fantastic health. Something is there, special." And if you go to the doctor and the doctor says, "My God, you're on death's door. There's something is there." Zen is all about that. See, whether it's the moment you wanted or the moment you didn't want, something is there. Or I should say, nothing is there, because that's how we normally experience it. It's like nothing. You know, the Buddha's word for enlightenment was the deathless. He said all conditions of being are unsatisfactory, and he said without exception. I've been rich. I was unhappy when I was rich. I've been, you know, I had power. I was very unhappy when I had power. And of course, the American says, "Oh well, just let me get him. You know, let me get him, and I'm sure I'll be happy." You know? But most of us are not going to have that opportunity to be infinitely rich and infinitely powerful anyway. There's something about this moment, whatever it is, which is enlightenment, and it's not about getting what you want or winning. It's there whether you win or whether you lose. Yeah, and so Zen practice is quite different from I think a place like Kripalu, and I'm not criticizing it. I'm not. It is a different experience. Because what we're doing is letting go. Zen practice is about letting go, not winning. The basic mentality of modern people is winning. Somehow I'll be able to pull this off. I'll be able to actualize myself. I'll be able to, and Zen is not about that. And at some point in a sesshin, you might come to sesshin and think, well, this is not what I asked for. This is not what I bargained for. And this is a bummer. You know, I've been in pain for, you know, hours and hours. Or it's noisy here, etc., etc. Or my roommate is snores. You know, if your roommate snores, you can go to another bed. But you know, maybe your roommate has other annoying habits. You know, well, this is, or maybe you don't like the room. But Zen is not about winning. At some point in the session, you're going to say, "I give up. I give up." That's it. I give up. Now, if you don't get in your car and drive away, being in a condition of "I give up" is actually a very interesting condition. It's really quite a beautiful state of existence, non-existence. Now, when you really give up, and we say in Zen, "Die on the cushion," you know, the whole character of your life changes. To be like a selfless mind is really quite a wonderful, really beautiful experience. So on day one, sesshin, for most people, it's just gradually letting go of all of our aspirations and our dreams. And usually day two, I should warn you, is where you really realize you're hanging by your teeth, or you're falling, you know, one or the other. But eventually, you know, if you hang in here long enough, if you stay to around day three, something really quite wonderful is going to happen to you. You know, if you were hoping for a sunny day and it rains, you're going to be very happy. And if you were hoping for a quiet, a serene environment, and somebody's tearing up the road 100 yards from here, you're suddenly going to find that even though this is not what you wanted, there's this extraordinary joy in life. And by the way, you'll feel this extraordinary joy even while your legs are killing you. I want to welcome everybody to Sesshin, and this morning we all got off to a wonderful start. People sat very deeply, and now the work, for those of you who came to last night, the work begins. You know, as I say, nobody wants to give up. And we just don't. We all come to Sesshin looking for something, some kind of, we all have an angle, right? That's just how we are. That's how the small self is. But at some point, you know, we just give up. And so the sooner that happens, the better. So please, if you're watching your breath, don't be too afraid of your pain. I'm sure you have pain. Just watch the breath, and when the pain it becomes unmanageable, cross your legs a little bit. When you have mental focus, you can or sit in a chair. When you have mental focus, sit back down on the cushion and fix your mind one-pointedly on the breath. When you do that, you'll notice that the pain shifts. It's no longer at the center of your attention, but it's off to the side. If your koan is mu, just keep going into deep mu shin until everything in the world disappears. You know, when you call mu, you say mo. Then your mind should be blank until you call mu again. And then your mind should be blank until you call mu again. This isn't always possible to sustain this for a long period of time, but that's what you want. And this is like emptying out. Little by little, we're going to empty out. And when that happens, we're going to live a bigger life. Kyogen Osho said, "It's like a man up in a tree hanging from a branch with his mouth. His hands grasp no bough, his feet rest on no limbs. Someone appears under the tree and asks him, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? If he does not answer, he fails to respond to the question. If he does answer, he will lose his life. What would you do? Mumon's comment, even if your eloquence flows like a river, it is no avail. Though you can expound the whole Buddhist literature, it is of no use. If you solve this problem, you will give life to the way that has been dead up until this moment, and destroy the way it has been alive up till now. That's it. We're up here. We're on this beautiful adventure together, and let's empty out on the cushion. And what was so alive will die, and what seemed so dead will really come to life.